Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education. Our website is insideed.com, where you can listen to or download podcasts of all previous Inside Education programmes. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. On this week's programme, I speak to an educator who will soon be advising US President Barack Obama. Professor Deborah Ball is Dean of the School of Education at the University of Michigan. Somewhat unusually for top-level academics in the United States, she taught in a primary school for 20 years. A few weeks ago, President Barack Obama announced his intent to appoint Professor Ball to the National Science Board in the United States. But last weekend, Deborah Ball visited Ireland and met with teachers, researchers, policymakers and teacher educators. Her visit to Ireland was hosted by the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment and the Marino Institute of Education. The theme of her visit was, "Great teachers are not born, they're taught." When I met up with Deborah, I asked her what she means when she says that great teachers aren't born, they're taught.
It's sort of a play on words because quite frequently in the United States, people say just the opposite. They say essentially great teachers are born. And that grows out of a pervasive belief, at least in our culture, that teaching is, on one hand, quite natural. That is, people teach as a matter of course. That's something human beings do. And people who are really good at it are people who are primarily have just great instincts about how to explain material, how to relate to young people. And when they say this, they're essentially denying the idea that teaching is something you could teach to people. Now, of course, there are people who have natural talent at teaching, there, just as there are people who have talent about almost anything, music, sports, and the like. But even when it comes to music or sports, we do believe that there are people who don't start with natural talent who can be trained to be quite skillful and even better than skillful at those areas of human activity. Even worse, though, teaching we can't really afford to rely entirely on people who are naturally good at it because we need so many teachers. In Ireland, I understand you have a teaching force of about 100,000 teachers, and you know the United States has a much larger population, and we have 3.75 million teachers. So it seems unlikely to imagine that even if one accepts that some people are born to be really good at teaching, in neither Ireland nor the United States would we ever approach that scale of people who are capable of just doing this naturally. So we coined the phrase great teachers aren't born, they're taught, to try to advance public understanding about the importance of really high quality professional training to do the work of teaching. Basically on the argument that if we really expect young people in both of our countries to become really good and prepared for adult life, we have a responsibility to ensure that they consistently have teachers who are skillful enough to do the work. And a system that relies on looking for talent or people who are naturally good at it is a system which essentially is essentially allowing it to chance whether children get teachers who really know what they're doing.
Some people might not maybe believe that teachers are born, but they might say, well, okay, they mightn't be born, but if they just watch somebody else doing it for long enough, they'll get good at it. What would you say to that?
Well, I've been watching football, American football, for a really long time. I actually like the sport a lot, pretty good at watching it. I can tell you that I'm no better at playing it now than I was when I first began to learn how to watch it. So there's a big difference between watching, analyzing, and observing and actually pulling things off. And you can imagine quite a few examples of that. For example, you can watch cooking shows on television. Doesn't lead you to actually know what good taste is or how to improvise with the ingredients. And you can think of many examples of crafts where we do watch regularly and it doesn't make us good at it. We go to concerts, it doesn't turn us into pianists or violinists. So on one hand, it is important to have opportunities to see really skillful teaching and to have talk about it with others who are really good at pointing out what the teacher was doing, just the same way that athletes watch game films and analyze the performance, but nobody becomes a skillful athlete simply by watching game films. They also have to get on the field, try things, get feedback, try again, fail, have someone stop and say, no, you have to hold your arm like this. And teaching is also like that. I think the problem is that neither teachers nor others have really been willing to admit that teaching is something that can be trained. In fact, there's been, at least in our country, quite an investment in preserving the idea that teaching isn't something you can be taught. And in fact, it somehow reduces it to technical skill if you do try to teach it, which I find to be a really disappointing way of thinking about teaching, because in fact teaching is quite complicated to do, and if you say that it's something that you can't really break down and try to teach, you're sort of back to this problem of how do you find people then who can do the work well.
I want to ask you a little bit more about how teachers are taught in just a moment, but you've used a word there, trained, and that's a word that we tried to get away from preparing teachers in Ireland. In the 1970s, we talked about teacher training colleges, and then they were changed to colleges of education. But you seem to be using the word trained. Why is that?
Well, in the medical school at the University of Michigan, where I work, I have to say, they're not shy about referring to medical training. And in fact, all the other professional schools on our campus, architecture, information, dentistry, and the like, all speak of training, because they're much more willing to acknowledge that these are practices of that human beings engage in that are actually require high degrees of skill and that require training to learn. In our country as well, nobody likes the word teacher training either, so don't interpret me as representing my country here. I have to make a strong argument for why I think training is a useful word in our country, and I'm using it deliberately because I'm trying to emphasize, as you can tell, that teaching is highly skilled and complex activity, and all other skilled and highly complex activities that we attempt to help others learn, we speak of those often as involving training, whether it's athletic training or medical training or training to become a nurse or to become a lawyer. We speak of training in all of these fields. So if we're unwilling to use the word training, it's almost as though we seem to be taking sides away from other skilled occupations and trades and making it seem that it doesn't require very detailed preparation to do the work well.
So if we go to the next step then, how are teachers taught to teach?
Are you asking me that question in general in our country or?
No, I'm actually interested, how do you propose that teachers should be taught to teach?
The way that my colleagues and I have been thinking about it, and I know that you're working on this here also at Marino, is by attempting to identify the most important tasks and skills required to teach effectively. As the body of knowledge and skill that should be taught to beginning teachers. So we analyze what it is teachers do on a day-to-day basis and try to identify the small set of things that are absolutely essential to ensure young people's learning. So an example of such a skill or capability would be the ability to assess whether children are learning as a result of particular sequence of lessons on a topic. A teacher really can't teach well if he or she isn't able to design an efficient method of asking questions or providing a short quiz or something that allows the teacher to check to make sure the children are learning. If one doesn't know how to do that, one could teach day after day after day after day and assign homework, but it would be a little bit like flying a plane with no instruments, where one would never know, like, where am I and am I actually closer to my destination? So being able to, in a very informal but regularized way, check to make sure that the students are learning what you're teaching is a fundamental skill, and it's not something that the average person would know how to do just by being told, oh, you should check your students' understanding. It wouldn't be easy to know how to do that. So checking for understanding and assessment would be one of those. Another example would be the ability to conduct an entire class discussion with all of the pupils in the class. So whether it's in science or in maths or in history, students are engaged in some activity or a task or some writing, and then the teacher needs to be able to pull the students together and discuss the topic and pull out the major ideas that students are to learn, have them learn how to listen to one another, make arguments for particular ways of thinking, and listen to each other and arrive at conclusions. And that's also something that is really quite difficult to do. So that would be a second kind of skill, leading a class discussion. So the goal would be to identify a small set of the most important skills that really aren't natural to know how to do, and then design very particular ways of, like you mentioned a moment ago, watching videotapes of someone doing this well, having an opportunity to have the person who's teaching you show you what the sub-techniques are and allow you to practice those. Maybe try it out with colleagues before you try it out on children. So before you have a discussion, maybe you try to lead a discussion of your peers in the teacher education program and see if you can do that before you even try to lead a discussion of children. All of these are things that are done in other fields when people are trained. Pilots don't begin by flying airplanes right away. They work in simulators. And nurses don't begin by inserting IV tubes into real people. They insert them into mannequins. So we need in education similarly to find ways to gradually take novice teachers and provide opportunities for them to try out these skills under supervision and to get feedback and gradually be ready to try out things in real schools and again get feedback, but still not be responsible for all of the teaching. So they kind of in a component way build up this small set of really crucial skills. And the final thing we would need to do then is to create assessments that where we could check to make sure that people who are about to enter the classroom as teachers have these skills and can do them reliably. So it's identifying the things that are needed to be learned, developing very careful ways of providing supervised practice, and then being able to assess teachers to make sure they can do these things.
I think, Deborah, that some listeners will be surprised to hear you saying that teachers don't currently learn to assess children's learning in the classroom.
It probably varies by program, but the skill of being able to ask a very well-pointed question at the end of a lesson in which you might present to students an example of the question you've been working on, but show them the wrong answer and ask them, you know, is this the right answer or the wrong answer? And if it's the right answer, why? If it's the wrong answer, why not? Is actually a difficult question to formulate well. And if you can do it well, you can learn a lot about what young people learn. There may well be programs that teach assessment, but at least from what I've seen by surveying programs, it's more on the order of they hear that assessment is an important thing to do, they see a few examples, but they don't actually practice building assessments that are coordinated with the actual lessons that they're teaching and see what the information is they get on the children and then get feedback. Well, your assessment was really inefficient, or your assessment allowed you to be deluded into thinking that children learned it when, in fact, you made it so easy that, of course, they got the answer right. And until you get feedback to learn to do this well, it's unlikely that just by knowing that you should be assessing or hearing that it's an important thing, unlikely that you'd be good at it right away. So in part, it's not just naming these skills, it's also a very careful kind of graduated and supervised practice that I'm arguing for.
And the other topic that you presented to Irish educators about was to teachers, and you spoke to them about helping all learners to become mathematically skillful. What was your main message for Irish teachers there?
I was trying to show the teachers with whom I was working that it was very important as we design the mathematics work for young children that we include attention not only to their ability to calculate, get the right answer, to understand concepts like to know what a fraction is or to know what a decimal number is, to be able to calculate with them, but also to be able to reason about mathematical questions, to be able to create graphs or tables or representations, and to develop the confidence that mathematics is something that's useful and that they, as learners, are capable of doing. Too often, what we do for maths in school concentrates almost exclusively on either concepts sometimes or more often sort of procedural fluency. And in the end, we're disappointed because some of the children still aren't particularly fluent with their numbers, but they also can't reason about problems. So I showed the teachers with whom I was working a number of examples, both of classrooms where the teacher was trying to work in this way, where they integrated work on concepts and procedures together with reasoning, representation, and being able to look at different kinds of solutions and compare them. I showed them what that would look like, and we worked for quite a while on examples of mathematics problems or types of tasks that learners could be given that would promote this much more robust kind of mathematical competence that I was calling mathematical skill. And it's quite clear that in the 21st century, many occupations, as well as, of course, the university that some students go on to, require a much more variegated and robust notion of mathematical skill than we've thought about in the 20th century. That is much more ability to reason, to represent, to use quantitative information. And schools have to catch up with that need, or we will be leaving students very far behind for the demands of adult life.
You're currently Dean of the School of Education, Deborah. What does that work involve?
It's sort of like being the head of school. So I'm a faculty member in the school, and we have a faculty of over 80 people. Who teach teachers and who also train graduate students. And my job is essentially the same as a school principal in a way. So I'm responsible for helping us to work together on curriculum that we provide for our students. I'm responsible for working with others to provide faculty development so faculty can enhance their skills as teachers and researchers. I'm in charge of helping to lead the hiring we do of new faculty. And I'm also the main person to oversee the way we recruit and admit students and the kind of attention we pay to our students while they're there, since they are the most important part of our school. It's a role that I'm appointed to, and I report to the provost of the university, so that would be like the second from the president of the university. And it's a job that is a temporary post. It's not a permanent career change. So I did it for 5 years, and I was reviewed and reappointed, and I will be doing it again for this second 5-year term. But my intention when I complete this term is to return to being a faculty member, where I can continue my own teaching and research and work for another dean.
And how have you found the job?
Well, the most exciting thing I've had an opportunity to do as dean has been to lead a major transformation of our teacher education program, which is what we were talking about a little while ago. We decided that we wanted to take the teacher education program we had and essentially turn it inside out so that it was much more focused on practice and on the very specific skills needed for high-quality teaching. And because I was dean, I was able to marshal the resources and create conditions for faculty to work together on the redesign of our curriculum, and in fact, even to teach together so that people had opportunities to learn to do this somewhat different kind of teaching that was really focused on practice. That would have been not possible to do had I not been the dean, because I was in a position of being able to lead a curricular reform. The other thing I also have really enjoyed in the role was we completed a 2-year very careful self-study of the entire school about how our students were experiencing the school, about the work we were doing, how much impact we were having on education and its improvement. And from that, we were able to identify key goals that we wanted to pursue in the next decade. In 2021, our school will be 100 years old, and we wanted to achieve certain targets by the time we turn 100. And it was really exciting to have the opportunity to study what we're up to, think about what the goals ought to be over the next decade, and to begin to set out the planning and the resources to enable us to learn how to achieve those goals by the time we hit 2021.
And as dean, presumably you have a great insight into what are the current educational topics that are preoccupying people right across the United States. What kind of issues and topics are occupying educators' minds at the moment?
Well, there's several that bear closely on the work we do. One is teacher evaluation has become a very hot policy topic in the United States. By teacher evaluation, I mean very systematic efforts to track how teachers are teaching, in particular tracing the effects of individual teachers on their individual learners' gains. And this has become quite a controversial topic because the methods of tracking how an individual teacher has affected her students' learning isn't very easy to do well. But these evaluation systems that are gradually, or maybe not so gradually, rapidly taking over in our country are high stakes for teachers, because teachers are being judged on their impact on their students, even though the techniques we have for ensuring that we're being really careful and reliable about those measurements are not as good as one might think. And so it's been a very controversial topic, and I'm actually leading the effort to build this evaluation system in my state, the state of Michigan, and I've learned a lot about how complicated this is. Other big topics in the United States include the persistent problem we have of minority and low-income and English language learner children getting much less good opportunity to learn in their schools. They're often in schools that have fewer resources than white children and middle and upper middle class children and Asian children. So there's still big gaps in what children are offered in our country, and consequently big gaps in what they gain from schooling, which then leads to big differences in what they bring to post-secondary schooling, university, and the like. So the big issues of educational inequality have not only not improved in our country, but in some ways have widened over the last decade. So that's a big topic. The good news, if since I could maybe mention something good about the United States, is that recently there's emerged an agreement among 45 of the 50 states to begin to develop a national curriculum in English language arts and in mathematics, which is an unprecedented reform for the United States. Most other countries, like Ireland, have a national curriculum, but the United States has never had that. And this is very unusual that we've reached this agreement. It will take a great deal of work, like better teacher education that's associated with this, materials for teachers to use, assessments of children's progress that are tied to this new curriculum. But for many of us, this is a very exciting and unusual development in our country, because it suggests that there might be a chance that we would build a more coordinated system than we've ever had before.
Dublin Radio at its best, 103.2. This is Dublin City FM.
And you're listening to Inside Education on Dublin City FM. My name is Sean Delaney, and my guest this week is Professor Deborah Ball, who is Dean of the School of Education at the University of Michigan. Some time ago, Deborah Ball wrote a paper asking the question, what makes educational research educational? I asked Deborah, what was that paper about?
I was trying to, with my colleague Francesca Forzani, we were trying to understand better what makes the research that could be done from inside of education different from the research that's done by people in other fields. For example, sociologists study education, historians study education. Obviously, psychologists have for the longest time been interested in questions of education. But in part because I was trying to think carefully about why we have faculties of education, or as we call them in the States, schools of education, one of my questions was, what is the reason for a research university to even have a faculty of education? One could say, well, you need a faculty of education to train teachers, but that wouldn't be sufficient probably for most universities to continue to have faculties of education. So that led us to the question of what's special about the research that would be conducted by people who are on a faculty of education that would warrant their being at a research university. And that was what began to lead us to think about the question, what is it about the work that's done by people in education, on education, that differentiates it from the work done by other social scientists who study education?
Are you saying then that as somebody who studies education from a psychological perspective or a philosophical perspective are not really engaging in what you would call educational research?
Well, it's important that to be clear that we're not claiming that a psychologist or a sociologist or someone trained in these other social sciences might not study an educational problem. But we were trying to define from there what is it that is special about work that might not ever get done if you didn't have people who are concerned with the insides of education. So the way we thought about it was not so much who the people were as what the nature of the work was. And to do that, we considered the kinds of problems that people might study that bear on education. For example, a psychologist might study something about the development of young children's ability to reason about scientific phenomena. And that would be an important thing to understand if you were inside of education. But that isn't itself an educational question. It's a question about the development of young children around some phenomena. And those insights that one might gain from that research could inform an educational question, like how would you design curriculum to help develop children's thinking? Or how might a teacher be attentive to the kinds of developmental commonalities in children's reasoning about science? But just knowing something about children's development in science isn't itself a question of education. So what we tried to understand was what would make something then about education, and we decided that we would define education research as research that studies something about the transactions among or between teachers, learners, the subject matter or content that's being taught or learned, something about the settings in which it's happening, to begin with. So it would be about transactions that are about the effort to deliberately affect learning through teaching or through something else. So it would be about the dynamic that results as you attempt to promote learning using curriculum, teaching, or other things. So that would make it education as opposed to simply something about children's development or something about the content and how it might be represented. But pretty quickly we realized that that was still a limiting point of view, because not all education research would be done inside of classrooms. So we extended the argument to claim that policy studies that similarly tried to understand the dynamic among the actors and the policy were also taking an educational perspective. For example, if you wanted to study the outcome of a particular governmental policy about assessment in, let's say, maths, you could just try to trace whether those who created the policy, what they had in mind, and you could just look to see what the outcomes or the effects were on children's learning several years later. That wouldn't itself be an educational question. But an educational question about policy would be to examine more carefully how people who are in positions inside of schools or teachers or anybody took up the policy, tried to interpret it, used it in their work, and how that in turn affected something about the dynamic of an educational transaction. So in effect, we were arguing that education research is work that looks at something educative, that is a deliberate effort to change something in education practice. And that to us seemed different than looking at questions that informed educational practice but weren't themselves about education.
So would you go a step further then and claim that current education research is more of the nature of research that informs education rather than actually getting down into the heart of it and studying it the way you envisage?
Well, in the paper, we tried to show examples of research that's both current and older research that we defined as being illustrative of our idea about education research. So one of our quintessential examples was research that was done now almost 30 years ago at Michigan State University in the U.S., in which researchers tried to study common misconceptions that young children had about photosynthesis. But they didn't stop at that. Had they only studied that, that would have, to our mind, been something that was useful and very interesting, but only informative of education. Instead, after they learned something about these misconceptions, they designed curricula that were deliberately planned to address the very specific misconceptions they'd uncovered. And then they worked with teachers who used these curriculum, and they compared classrooms where teachers used these curriculum with teachers using other methods. So then they had converted the question they were studying from one of simply identifying that children were likely to misunderstand photosynthesis to a set of studies programmatically in which they sought to understand what might you do to intervene on those such that you could begin to address the misconceptions and lead students to develop more robust and scientific understandings of how plants make their own food.
And finally, Deborah, you've been in Ireland, well, just for over 2 days now. What have you observed about Irish teachers or the Irish education system or Irish schools that maybe you didn't know beforehand?
Well, I hadn't known very much about the maths project. What was it called again?
Project Maths.
Yeah, Project Maths, so you had it backwards. I hadn't known very much about that, and I had the opportunity to learn a bit about it from people who have been both assisting, supporting teachers to do it and teachers who have been working with it. I also had the opportunity to learn about these three reports that have just been published that provide some insight from research about how these have affected or been shown up in curriculum, how teachers have been working, what children have been learning, and so on. So I was very interested to learn about that because I had not been aware that there had been a pretty major effort to develop the mathematics curriculum in this country, and I'm really eager to read the reports and to learn more. I was also struck with the coordination here in this country among different sectors between the universities, the teachers' colleges, policymakers, the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment. We just don't have anything like that in the United States where you get this degree of crosstalk among people who work in education. And I was very impressed to see the possibility of improvement for Irish schools because of people who work in very different parts of the system who actually know each other because you're a small country and not only know each other but are using what they're capable of doing from wherever that is they work in the system and working together.
And that was Deborah Ball, who is in Ireland as a guest of the National Council for Curriculum Assessment and of Merino Institute of Education. Well, that's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on InsideEd.com or on iTunes. You can email me at InsideEducation@DublinCityFM.ie. Thanks to my guest, Deborah Lohenberg Ball from the University of Michigan. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening. Thank you.